Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Baleria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. We can also be found on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joey Altman, host of Cron's Bay Cafe and Food Network's Appetite for Adventure and Tasting Napa, and currently the consulting chef of Miss Pearl's Jam House Restaurant in Oakland's Jack London Square. This program is part of our Food Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Today, I have the great pleasure to introduce Chef Jacques Pepin, one of the brightest stars to have ever shone in the culinary world. Mr. Pepin is currently the host of Fast Food My Way and author of the new cookbook, More Fast Food My Way. Pop culture has produced the phenomena of celebrity chefs, high-profile figures with eponymous restaurants, television shows, books, magazines, kitchenware, specialty foods, and even clothing. We know their catchphrases and their soups and can recognize them no matter what product they're selling or what kind of suspicious scarf they may be wearing. What is unique to our guest is that Jacques Pepin's celebrity has never overshadowed his being a chef. While he has guided millions through some of the most ambitious meals ever attempted, he has delighted as well in demonstrating a simple, elegant way to clean an artichoke. As to sex appeal, I don't think Bobby Flay and Jamie Oliver combined could have stirred as many hearts as the charming Monsieur Pepin.
Sure.
Ladies in the house, can I get a hey? Your appetite properly whetted, I just need to inform you that we will be conducting today's interview in Chef Pepin's native language, Franglish. Franglish, that's broken English with a heavy French accent. Just kidding. From this light note, I turn to a true heavyweight in the industry, a man of extraordinary accomplishments spanning 50 years, who rose from a childhood spent in the kitchens of his family's restaurants to being tapped as a personal chef to French presidents. Highlights of his career include 3-star restaurants and multi-million dollar chains, a hosting stint that became a multiple award-winning television series, and cookbooks that are the foundation of modern cooking paradigms. Here with his latest book, More Fast Food My Way, please, with me, welcome Jacques Pepin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Joy.
Well, it's truly an honor to be here with you. In 2004, your show, and with the companion book, Fast Food My Way, you showed us how to create simple, special meals in minutes. Now you're back with More Fast Food My Way. Are these recipes you didn't have enough room for the first time, or did you find that the first ones weren't fast enough?
Both. sometimes you do a television show that I do at KQED here in San Francisco. I have been doing 11 television series at KQED. So each series is 26 shows. So multiply by 3-4 recipes plus. So we do about 120, 130 recipes. So when I work on one series, I concentrate on this. And very often, the subject itself is determined by focusing in one area of food. I mean, I had a column in the New York Times for 8 years called The Purposeful Cook. It was how to cook for a family of six for the least amount of money. So I did a book called Cuisine Economic, you know. And then I did a book for cardiac patient weight loss for the Cleveland Clinic. So that was really focused in another area. Then I did those books of technique, which are illustrated manual of cooking techniques. So that's very, at the other hand, if you want, showing from the beginning the kind of manipulation that you need to do in a professional kitchen. And in that case here, I decided to try to make people's life easier by doing the type of food that I only did occasionally sometimes. That is, everyone cooked this way. My mother, my French chef, you do. Everyone occasionally, you know, you spend the weekend 6-7 hours behind the stove, and then it's Tuesday, you go out, and you go shopping, you come home at 5 o'clock, you're hungry, so I get into the pantry, get a can of cannellini beans, then forage through the freezer, get a chorizo, cut it, and make a soup in 5 minutes. So it was a question of extrapolating those recipes to make that type of food, to show you how to do it, and also to use the supermarket as a prep cook. See, when you go in a professional kitchen, you have the prep cook who come in the morning, we call la mise en place, doing the preparation, boning out the fish, boning out the chicken, slicing the mushroom, chopping the shallots, doing the stew of tomato, everything is done for you. So by the time you stand at the stove, the first order of fish, you grab one of those fillets done, a bit of shallots, some sliced mushroom, a bit of white wine, bring it to a boil, cook it a minute, take it out, reduce the stock, finish the sauce, it takes you 5, 6, 7 minutes because someone did those preparations for you. So I decided to do the same thing with the supermarket. So I can get a boneless, skinless breast of chicken and pre-sliced mushroom, pre-washed spinach. The salad is clean up. I have a non-stick pan, and so forth. And I can do a dish from scratch for 7, 8 minutes. This is what I did here. Different than it was used to be.
Yes, quite a bit. Yeah. Now, most major cities have great restaurants and great prep food already in the supermarket. Uh-huh. Why should people spend any amount of time in the kitchen when so much is already available? What's the benefit they will get from even doing the minimal amount of cooking?
It's not even a question of benefit. It's a question of joy. You know, you have to cook with joy. You have to cook with the family, and even more so, you have to sit with the family and eat together. This is a very, very important part of our structure, part of our life. And if you do that type of cooking, you spend more time with the kid around the table because that doesn't take any time to cook. So that I think, is very important. And the point that you make, saying that there is so many restaurants and so many eating in the supermarket, and it's true. And people say no one cook anymore. Well, I tell you, the supermarket have never been as beautiful as they are today. And if no one cook, I mean, what do they do with the stuff at the end of the week? Someone is cooking somewhere because they replenish it every week, you know, so.
That is very, very true. I just want to remind everybody, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we're talking with Chef Jacques Pepin.
This is a radio program?
It is a radio program.
Oh, okay.
You were wondering why you weren't wearing makeup, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you were developing these recipes for the new book, what was your sort of process? Did you start with an ingredient, a technique, or simplify an existing, more complicated recipe?
I think you always start with an idea, you know? And each time, even along the road, I'm doing 16 cities here in a book tour that I'm doing. And, of course, I live, as I say, in Connecticut. As you can recognize, my Yankee drawl is pure Connecticut Yankee. But so along the way, you know, I see something, whether it's in a restaurant or someone is doing something, I say, yeah, that's a good idea. I write it down so I have full yellow pad full of idea too. And then we decide that we are going to do the series. So I start looking at all of those ideas, breaking them down, trying to do 26 menu. That is so many of this, so many of that, so many soup and so forth. And then actually I cook almost every night when I am at home. I always did. And I've been married 43 years, so, you know, my wife cooks as well. But so I just go to the market and get ingredients, start with an idea, and as you put A and B together, you know, you create a new entity, and then you kind of react to the food, and you go maybe where you didn't want to go, but then you come out with a recipe. And that's basically the way it works for me, you know, because I don't have a restaurant. I have Norma with my assistant, and she's been with me, I think, 27 years. And then my wife, who really doesn't even get involved into that part of the business, so it's a very small. I do my recipe, I write it down by hand, she typed it, I redo it, do an introduction to, and that's basically it, you know.
With all your travels, what kinds of trends are you seeing?
You.
The wine has just been delivered.
What?
Okay, dealer's choice.
What do you have for him? Do you have some for him?
Okay, he's got white all and red, right. And he's passing me the red. Oh, you are a true gentleman.
Yes. Well, we
cheers
to you.
And thank monsieur you. Bon vivant. So what I should... Yeah,
we
bad
also
luck
have
not
a,
to drink when you cheers.
Yeah, this is better than Chateau Fink here.
Hey, don't knock our water here in the Bay Area. We've got great water.
I love water.
So I was What trends have you been seeing lately that you're really excited about in American cooking, whether it's in the home or in restaurants?
To start with, you know, you would have to define for me what American cuisine is, which is maybe...
Maybe not American cuisine, just in your travels around our country
which
here.
Which maybe the fact that it's undefinable, that may be the definition of it, because there is so many ethnic groups here, so many different ideas, so many things that you see, which is a conundrum, you know, in many ways. It's certainly puzzling for many Europeans. I mean, I don't consider that I've been here most of my life. Next year, it's going to be 50 years that I'm here. But certainly for many Europeans, they believe that Americans eat five dishes. They eat hot dog, hamburger, hot dog, fried chicken, pizza, and canned macaroni or whatever. So, let's think about that for a minute. There is some truth in this. You know, the point is that if you go to the mall and a big crowd, you will have people who eat basically five dishes, and it goes over and over again. That's what they eat. And in that context, the spectrum of taste is going to be shorter than a European. However, conversely, you go to an urban center, certainly San Francisco, in New York, Chicago, and so forth, basically all over, even in New Haven, Connecticut, you will one night eat Korean, then another night you eat Turkish, and another night you eat French, another night Italian, and so forth, because of those ethnic groups. And in that context, then the spectrum of taste there is much larger than most European. You know, so there is that type of dichotomy, which, in my opinion, did not exist when I first came to this country. You know, so
What
was your question anyway?
So. I'm gonna repeat the question because you're dodging it. I kind of feel that thanks to people like you and other great chefs on TV have inspired so many people to take food and cooking much more seriously and make it much more part of their life. I think it's raised the bar not only in the home but in restaurants. And while we see, we hear a lot about fast food being really sort of an epidemic in this country, I think also boutique lettuces are an epidemic, and other gourmet stores are also popping up.
No question. I mean, you know, we call that fast food. I say fast food my way. Fast food is a catchword. Maybe it'd be better to say food fast my way. You know, instead of fast food, it doesn't have the same connotation. And it is true that when I came to America 50 years ago, there was one salad in the supermarket, that was iceberg, period. You know, now, you know, any young chef is not going to be taken alive unless he gives me 15 type of green on the plate, so it goes back the other way. But certainly there is a return to, people are getting closer to the earth, to the farmer, and a bit all over the country. And I think that it's a great thing because too much has been said about the chef and probably not enough about the farmer, because we are nothing unless someone grows the food for us. And my mother and father were organic farmers. Of course, the word organic did not exist at that time and they wouldn't have known what it meant. I just meant to say that chemical fertilizer did not exist, and fungicide, insecticide, pesticide, all that stuff did not exist. So we use cow manure or whatever, and we do the garden, which is what I do in Connecticut. So it seems that we forget that, and we are coming back to it, and more people are trying to buy local product and buy it not too far from your house, which is the way it used to be, and this is a great, great thing. Even in a small town, I live in a town of 8,000 people in Connecticut, and there is a farmer's market on a Friday afternoon during the summer. And I think it's very exciting. When I was a child, I could recognize what I ate. Even at age 3 or 4, a kid would say, this is a tomato, this is a raspberry, this is a chicken. For many people now, a chicken is rectangular, it's got plastic on top, and it doesn't have any head or feet, you know, so... A kid don't recognize the food. And it's even more so when you ask a kid who is 4 years old who is going to show you a package which is blue and green with some type of cartoon character on top, and this is how they determine what they're going to eat. They say, I want this because of advertisement on television. That's so far away from knowing what you're eating. You look at the package, and it's all processed food, all kind of chemical too. This is very scary when you see kids recognizing and deciding on what they're going to eat according to that type of criteria. And that we have to get away from. So sitting together, eating together, and cooking with the kid. You know, that's very important. I have a granddaughter with 4.5 now. If I hold her, like I hold Claudine, and she stirred the pot once, she, quote, made it. So she's going to eat it because she's involved in it, you know.
Exactly.
So that's very important.
Well, I'm going to use your talking about farming for my next question here. I think farmers markets are becoming hugely popular all over the country. We have a fantastic number of them here in San Francisco.
I was at the Ferris building today, so.
It's gorgeous. So we're we're a couple weeks into fall, wrapping up our summertime love affair with corn and tomatoes and stone fruit. What are you looking forward to in fall and winter, and what kinds of dishes? And if you want to include recipes, please do so.
Okay. Well, you know, the holidays are coming, and there is that chill in the air, certainly in Connecticut. I talked to my wife this morning. She put the fireplace on, you know, and we get to root vegetable now, parsnip, as well as butternut squash and other, which we cut in cube, and I cook it with a little bit of maple syrup and some cider vinegar. Maybe water, and you cook it, and a piece of butter, and eventually when the liquid evaporates and it's tender enough, it caramelizes, and that's great. I love Brussels sprout. Claudine loved Brussels sprout when she was a kid. But then you don't cook it until it's khaki in color, you know, and smells strong, you know. I slice it very thin with a mandoline or with a food processor. You know, use your cuisinier, you can slice it thin. And a little bit of olive oil or a couple of slices of bacon, chopped very fine. You put that raw in it and you saute 2-3 minutes, crack paper on top too, and you have a great, it's very good. So many of those simple, probably a lot of vegetable salad. I have the mash, you know, which is the doucette or mash in my garden. Now is going to come after the first frost, that's where it will be good. I have some curly endive, which are getting white now because it's the time of the year. So, you know, there is excitement to each season for me. And, of course, the oyster clam in the fall now. I have a lady with a fisher woman, and I can call her, and she brings me a bag of oyster and bag of clam, you know, for a very good price. So I gave her a couple of books. So.
Well, I think that's the beauty of the seasons. By the time it comes back around, you're excited for that kind of food
Absolutely. And that's why we should eat seasonally, you know, because if you have a tomato in full summer, that's when it is the best in terms of taste, but it's also the best nutritionally wise. You know, it has reached peak, and it is where the time is the cheapest. So why not? You know, we used to do that. We do it less now because the lines are getting blurry with the market, getting stuff, you know, from all over the world, you know, at different time of the year. But yet still, you can feel, you know, in January when you see beautiful raspberry that your mind says they are strawberry, but your palate doesn't really believe it, you know, so it's not the time of the year.
Well, I'm going to change gears a little bit here. I've got some questions about young people who want to get into cooking and potentially become chefs. And one of the things that I've noticed as a chef here in San Francisco, and I know chefs all over the country are dealing with this as well, is that tuitions at cooking schools are now as high as some major universities.
Amazing.
However, upon graduating, former students are now looking at a long road of low to medium-paying wages,
Absolutely.
Building their careers. How do you think this will affect the culinary world, and will our best and brightest chefs go to debtor's prison?
No, they'll go to the Food Channel Network and become Bobby Flay. So,
okay, that's four of them.
Yeah.
And in a year, there'll be one of them.
No, but, you know, you have to go into that business for the right reason, and the right reason is love, you know. If you love it, if you feel gratified by it, then it's fine. You can face this, you can face the long hours because you still work 12, 14 hours a day, you still sweat a lot, you still work weekend, you still work holiday, and you relatively make very little money, you know, unless some exception, you know, like you and, you know, Emery Lagasse or people like you, but otherwise.
Listen,
But it's true. So, but if you go for the right reason, that is, you're gratified by it, you love it, then it's worth it. But as you said, during my time, of course, there was no school. You went into apprenticeship with a chef and worked behind the stove, which is what I did when I left home, and I was 13 years old, 13 and a half. So it's a different way of learning. And I look, I am dean of study at the French Culinary Institute in New York City, and I teach at Boston University for the last 24 years as well. I mean, the program there is like $41,000 for 9 months. I mean, the price are crazy, and they're all more or less the same, you know. It's very, very, very expensive, without any question. It's like going to college also. I mean, the kid has to borrow a lot of money.
Right. But I imagine when you have students coming up to you and say, I want to be like you, I want a TV show, I want to write cookbooks, how do you not, like, backhand them and say, get a job first and learn how to cook? And I'm kidding, but I imagine that it must be hard and frustrating sometimes to impress upon these students how much of it is just grunt work.
Especially a young chef, you know, very excited. And the mistake that they make is too much, you know, too much stuff on the plate, too much to impress and so forth. When in fact, you know, you don't have to worry about that because you cannot escape yourself. And you are who you are and you have no choice. I give a class at BU. We are offering actually at BU a Master of Liberal Art with a concentration in gastronomy, which to my knowledge is still the only place in the country, a program that we set up with Julia about, 14, 15 years ago. But I teach for four different departments. One of them is a certificate in the culinary art, which is a three-month program. So there are like 12, 15 people. I was there 3 weeks ago. So I work with them for 3 days when I go. So one of the demonstrations that I do sometime, I do like the perfect meal. So I do a roast chicken, a boiled potato, and a salad. You know, the roast chicken has to be roasted properly, basted with natural juice. The salad is usually a Boston lettuce, which is what I like, one type of salad, minimalism, you know. But it has to be cut properly, it has to be washed properly, it has to be drained properly, it cannot be bruised, it has to be cool but not ice cold. All of this, then you do a dressing with fresh cracked pepper, you know, a little bit, the best possible olive oil, a little bit of the fat of the chicken too, that goes on top, then a little bit of the juice of the chicken goes on the salad. The potato is cut at the same size, it's boiled so many minutes, you drain it, you put it back on the stove to draw out the remaining moisture, just a bit of butter in it and serve it right away, the chicken is cut. So this is not complicated. It's simple, but the right way, and that's a perfect meal, as I said. Now, they have to go to the stove, and they all duplicate that. I have 15 people, and I tell them, please don't be innovative and try to create stuff out of it. Cook with your guts, and it will be fine, because regardless of who you are, you cannot escape yourself anyway, and I have 15 people here, I will have 15 different chicken. Two or three practically perfect, three cold, three undercooked, three overcooked, three whatever, but they will be different because, as I said, there is no way you can escape yourself. So I'm saying that for young chefs who absolutely want to sign that dish to make sure that I'm the one who did it, you don't have to do it. If you are who you are going to be different than the one next to you because they cannot duplicate what you do. And that's what we try to do. Instead of doing things so complicated, I will, being the devil's advocate, I would say, okay, I want you to take a Reuben sandwich, you know, a hot dog, a lobster roll or whatever, five simple stuff, a BLT, and make it better than anyone else. There is always a place where you can have it better. You have a better mustard on top on your hot dog or a better roll, or it's brown out better or whatever, but you work in depth rather than working only to have something showy and all this.
Right. Know? Very different than your apprenticeship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We never learned the trade. We stole it. You know, it's true. I mean, the chef will say, do that, which is probably right for someone with 14 years old. And if you had said why, which you would not have said to start with, but if you had said why, you would have said, because I just told you. Okay, that was the end of it. So you work, and you do this, and you do that. You work like for a year, and all of a sudden he say, you, until I went to the stove, I was called you, Opti, you know. Then he called me by my name. And so you start at the stove tomorrow. I said, me? I mean, the stove came up to here. I mean, I was very small. I said, and I knew how to do it. So there is a question of osmosis. You're there, you learn through looking too, and that's how we used to learn, certainly as kids. And it was a different way, but on the other hand, I am at the French Culinary Institute. The people who graduate after 6 or 9 months, they do stuff that I would never have been able to do after 3, 4, 5 years. I was much faster with my hand and all that because you have so much cleaning and so much shopping and, you know, that I get technically better. But in terms of what they can do after that time is different because now we cater to them, we explain, we show them.
So much and, more exposure also
exposure
to so
too,
many different ideas.
Because they pay a fortune. And I have to say in that context, I have a series on PBS called The Complete Technique of and all of those techniques Like at the French Culinary Institute, we have what we call 250 competencies. That is the competency, you take eggs, you have to show boiled eggs, hard-cooked eggs, scrambled eggs, this, and so forth. So there, in the technique that I show you, which I did a series of 13 shows on PBS, how to chuck an oyster, bone out a chicken, bone out a fish, do a caramel cage, beat an egg white, those are the classic things which never change. Because the book that I did, La Technique, is 35 years old, and it's still current now, because the recipe changed, but the technique, the way you chuck an oyster, is the same. So those are on tape, and it costs like, I don't know, it's sold by PBS, maybe 30, 35, 40 bucks, whatever it costs. So this is a good thing to buy for an apprentice instead of the school right. that are a fortune. You know?
I tell people, go volunteer at a restaurant. Even pay the chef $10,000, and then you leave with a resume.
I advise exactly the same thing I did last week. People tell me, well, my son or my daughter, you know, want to go into that business. I say, how old are they? Say 15, 16, 17. I say, well, let them finish high school or fully college, but for each vacation, find them a job in a restaurant. As dishwasher, in the front room, prep you know, cook. As a server, in the kitchen, here, there, and so forth. And if they still love it in 3-4 years, after a few summers spent there, then they can go into that business. It's likely that they say, I'm not going to do that. I mean, you
know. Right. Okay, we're going to shift again. The audience is just dying to know. You know, Bogey had Bacall, you had Child. Tell us about the on-screen chemistry with Julia Child, and also people know that you have had really close relationships with Andre Sultanair, James Beard, Craig Claiborne, Pierre Franet, who is a mentor to you. Tell us some of your inspirations.
It was a different world, you know. The world of food was very, very small. I came here at the end of 1959. I worked at the Pavillon in New York, which was considered, you know, the greatest French restaurant in the country. And Pierre Franet was the executive chef. A few weeks later, Craig Claiborne, who just started at the New York Times, came to do a piece on Pierre. I met Craig, we became friends, and through Craig, I met Helen McCauley, who at the time was the food editor of McCall, House Beautiful, and she kind of became my surrogate mother. She had never married, she never had any children, so telling me, don't wear those stupid socks you have in France, don't do this, don't do that. Anyway, so Helen spoke with James Beard on the telephone 2 hours every day about whatever was going on in the food world. So through Helen, I met James Beard a few months later, and maybe 5-6 months after that again, Helen, I used to cook with her at her apartment. I live on 50th and 1st Avenue, and she lived on 53rd and 1st Avenue in New York. She said, you know, I have a manuscript of a book. I want to show it to you. Someone sent me there, and the author is coming to New York next week, so you can come to my apartment. We'll cook for her, and she said she's a very big woman and she has the worst voice you ever heard in your life. And of course, this was Julia, and at that time, I remember speaking French with her more than English because she just came back from 5-6 years in France and spoke pretty good French. And what I'm saying is that I was here like a year, maybe, you know, barely, and I knew the trinity of cooking, you know, I mean, James Beard, Craig Claiborne, and Julia Child. So you see how small the food world was compared to now. And in that context, it was difficult to do a book at the time. I did La Technique, a book that I wrote in 73-74, and I think was published in 75. And it was not easy to have a book published because publisher did not want to do a cookbook. However, if you published it, you were almost sure that people would look at it because the same year there were maybe 8-10 books were published. Now, it's not that it's difficult to do a book, but last year there were 2,500 cookbooks in America. So it's an embarrassment of riches. You don't even know which to look at. It's amazing, you know, the amount of information. So it's a different world.
Yeah. Tell me about Martin Yan. Somebody wants to know if you, Martin Yan, Iron Chef, what ingredient could you surely take him down with?
I think he'll use a cleaver and I'll use a French chef knife. You know, Martin is a good friend of mine. Actually, I started at KQED with Martin Yan because of him. I did a series for PBS with Jacksonville, Florida, I think in 1982. With a book called Everyday Cooking with Jacques Pepin, Simple Food too. And then I came here during all the, 82. But prior to this, during the 70s and 80, I was giving class 30 weeks, 35 weeks all over the country to cooking school. It coincided with the time that cookware shop exploded, cooking school opened, which was new. So I start doing that, and people say, can we book you for next year? So I had a complete agenda a year ahead of doing that. That's how I made a living. Because in 74, yes, it was the end of the 70, I had a very bad accident and I had 14 fracture. So I didn't want to go back 12, 15 hours a day in the kitchen. And anything is easier than that, really. So I started giving class, and at some point I was in Foster City at Martin's cooking school. And I had met him before, and I gave a series of class for a week. And he said, I'm shooting some show for PBS here this week. Can you come and do a couple of shows with me? I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I went there, and I did a couple of shows. And Marjorie Poore, I think, was the executive producer at the time. And she said, we'd like to do a series with you. I said, great, I'd love to. Now, I had been asked to do a series by WGBH, which is Boston, as well as WNET, which is New York, so that the two biggest stations. And I said, great, but they never find the money, so we never did the series. It always amount to this, finding the funding for it. So when they asked me there, I said, fine, but I didn't really expect it to fly, and it was like September. She said, we'll have the funding by Christmas. When can you do it? I said, I cannot do it until next July because I am on the schedule for the cooking school. She said, fine, July is July. So Christmas came and went. They didn't have the funding. The end of January, they didn't have the funding. The end of February, they didn't have the funding. And she kept telling me, no, we're going to get it. And my wife, at some point in March or April, she said, are we going to France? We are going to go see my mother or whatever. I said, well, I think so. I don't think I'm going to do that thing. And Marjorie Poore again called me. She said, give me until the 15th of April. I say, fine. The 14th at night, she said, it's a go. We have the thing. I said, oh, God. Then I had to do 120 recipes or whatever doing fast, and we did the first series, and it kind of mushroomed into another one, and I have been with KQED since then, and that was 88, something like that.
Well, television obviously has been very good for me. It's the only reason why I'm sitting next to you here. And tell me about how television has affected your life in a bigger way. And what did you do to be sitting next to me?
Well, I beg the people of comment. Well, I like to teach, and teaching is what I do. People will like me, or people won't care one way or the other, or people will detest me. It doesn't really matter. You cannot, as I say, escape yourself. You are who you are, and it's much easier to be who you are than trying to be someone else. So I teach. That's what I do. I did that with literature at some point. I taught skiing, weekend for years. And cooking is what I know the best. It's what I do the best, so that I teach cooking. And always done that, and we did that with Julia as well. It is not necessarily true of other people, but for me, this is what I wanted to do. And when I go to the Food & Wine Festival in Aspen, the Food & Wine magazine, it's the Food & Wine Classic, and it's last year with the 26th year, I think. And I think I did it 23 times or 22 times. So I did it a long time. There were 5,000 people there, and from Emery Lagasse to Lydia Bastianich to Mario Batali, me, everyone is there. Well, when I go there, people will come and talk to me and say, I look at all the shows on television, you're the best. And the reason people tell me that is that the people who can't stand me don't come to talk to me. It's only the people who like me come and talk to me.
Audience.
Another group will go to Bobby Flay and say, you're the best on television. And that's fine. That's the way it is. We all have our own people that you can, identify with better. And personally, I learn everything I know from you, and I identify totally with you.
I'm not going to touch that one. as far as watching other chefs on television, what's your thoughts on these new reality shows like Top Chef and Hell's Kitchen? Do you enjoy them? Do you don't watch them? Do you find them silly?
Frankly, the last series that I did of 26 shows, if I've seen four, that may be... I may not even have seen four. This one, I have not seen any yet. I'm kind of addicted to MSNBC, all the news channel, stuff like that, and PBS as well. I don't really look much a cooking show on television, although I do see it occasionally. I've seen Top Chef, yes, and I have been part of it. I have seen The Iron Chef a couple of times, I think. another show on television, you know, everyone does his own things and react to it, and the reality show, as you say, some like it, some don't. For me, you know, it's always interesting to see someone else, but I mean, I don't...
Do you find it's like just a rising tide raises all boats, that if there's any interest in cooking, it's helping everybody who's involved in cooking?
Oh, absolutely. Without any question, Emery Lagasse is a good friend of mine, and what he's done for cooking, I would never have been able to do it. I mean, getting into a redneck country just because of my accent, I'll be dead. You know, there's no way. No way that I could do the kind of inroad that he did to bring people into cooking, you know. There's no way that I could do that. I realize that perfectly well. So, yes, anyone who can do that and cook and be who they are, I mean, Julia was on the, you know, outside camera, like on camera, exactly the same. When I did the show with her, we actually started at BU because she lives in Cambridge, which is in Boston on the other side of the river. And so I call her and, you know, I cook at her house or I do breakfast or we have lunch together or dinner. And then we started doing some class for the student at BU and we had a great time. So at some point I say, let's do a special for PBS. So we did Cooking in Concert, which was very successful, that we taped at BU. And then a year and a half or two later, we did another Cooking in Concert, and that was basically a catalyst or the genesis of the series that we eventually did together. And we had a great time because they made a lot of our differences, like she liked, white pepper, and I like black pepper, and she used it. But ultimately, we really felt the same way on most of the important issue. But conventionally, when you do a show like I did here, I come to the station with the manuscript, you know, and we do like 3 shows a day. Sometimes I did 4 shows a day, so we taped it in like 8-9 days. It's pretty fast, you know. And the first 3 series that I did here, I did it on time because they say, you know, editing is very expensive, so I had to do 4 dishes. And I do it on time, and someone is going in front of me telling me, okay, 20 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, I have to finish the 4 dish kind of looks you have, which is could be a bit straining, you know. So when I did it with Claudine, my daughter, Claudine was supposed to be the vox populi, you know, asking the question that people would have to ask me if they could, you know. So she was there. So I say, you know, it's going to be very difficult to do it on time with Claudine, because I'm showing her how to do a pâte boisée or a dough, and she's rolling it and struggling, and someone goes in front of me 3.5 minutes, so I push the kid over, I grab the thing and did it, you know, 3 minutes. So, fine, they say, you go ahead, but don't go too far. So we did 35, 38 minutes, and they had to edit it. We did the show with Julia. She said, you know, we're going to cook. When it's finished, we'll tell you. Wow. I think the longest show, we did a show almost 2 hours, you know. And I was surprised when I saw some of those shows, the way they were edited. It looks great. I mean, the editing, you know, was amazing. In addition to that, I come with a manuscript so that the back kitchen has an idea of what I'm going to do today. We had no recipe. We work thematically. I say, okay, we're going to do stew today, or we're going to do this, that. And we, most of the time, change 5 minutes before we started. So the camera or the back kitchen didn't really know what we were going to do. I mean, we decide in the morning. So when we finished the show, it was in the can for 2 years before it was on the air, because the Random House, Knuff, had to look at those shows ad nauseam, you know, to extrapolate the recipe and to do the book. It was a total reversal, you know, of what you normally do. But it was fun. And Julia was never the one to kowtow to the sponsor, and that's why we like to be on PBS. Because we don't even have the right to show the stuff a sponsor, so it's great. So, but you don't really have to antagonize a sponsor either. So one time we had like the president of Lando Lake who came. So it's not like we didn't use butter. I mean, Julia would put 2 sticks of butter, 3, and I remember one time I said, Julia, you have too much butter in there. She told me, you'll regret it. I said, okay, fine. So anyway, president is there, he goes into the front room in her salon there, which was a control room. And so the producer tells me, what are you going to do today? I say, well, I'm doing a pâte boisée, I'll do a big tart, and with the same one, I'll do a chicken pot pie. And we decide with Julia. She said, yes. So just before we start, Julia said, I want to do my own dough. I said, fine, great, it's no problem. So we start the show. I did a pot brisé, roll it, did the tart, put it into the oven. And I said, now, Julie, I want to do her own dough. She want to do another dough. And she said, no, Jacques is going to do it. I said, I am. Jack. No, she called me Jack, yes. So she said, I want you to do it in the food processor. I said, okay. So I got the food processor. How much flour you want? She said, a couple of cups. She said, yes. I put 2 cups of flour in it. A dash of sugar, a dash of salt. I said, how much butter do you want in it? She said, I want Crisco. I said, what do you mean you want Crisco? We don't have Crisco. She said, we have Crisco. She had Crisco. She had a can of Crisco underneath that she came and we put half butter and half Crisco when the president of Land O'Lake was there, you know, to show. So that was Julia, you know.
Sabotage. I just want to remind everybody you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we are talking with Chef Jacques Pepin. I'm Joey Altman. Wow, it was like jazz cooking.
Uh-huh. No, it was fun because it actually duplicates more the way it is when you cook with a spouse, because since we didn't have a recipe, why did I put those mushrooms in that dish? Because they happened to be there. I had mushrooms, we throw them in, whatever. And you can argue back and forth because you don't really have to have a set recipe. See, there is that type of paradox, you know, when you do a recipe, because when you do a recipe, you start with an idea. You know, I said, gee, I have chicken, those breasts of chicken there, those. Maybe with some, if I cut some zucchini this way too, it may be a good idea. I'm going to deglaze it too. So first I start with the idea, which often after so many years, almost 6 years in the kitchen, I can kind of test it in my head. So, but by the time I put A and B together, then you react to it. Then it looks this way, you do that. Now it goes too fast, you lower. So I write down, lower the heat to 325. Okay. And then it looks a bit dry. I put a third of a cup of water, add a third of a cup of water. I react to the food and write it down. You know, but there is a certain freedom when you start to do whatever I want, to react to the food. But by the time I finish this, I have a typewritten page, which is totally structured, which is what I give you. So it's a total reversal. You start with that totally structured thing as opposed to the opposite, you know. But there is no way out of it. This is the way it is. So a recipe should be for you an idea, you know, that you look at and you follow that idea more or less. I mean, the first time, you should really follow it pretty closely so that, and if it comes out good, you're likely to do it again. And when you do it again, you take a faster look. By the third time, a faster look. And by the fourth, fifth time, you quote, approve the recipe, you know. You say, I think I put more tomato in there and I won't do that. And a year later, it becomes your recipe and you don't know where it came from. This is a normal process, you know, the way it should be, I think. What I thought we had questions from the audience.
Yeah,
this is from the audience?
Yeah, some of these
are from
the audience.
Oh, I thought it was yours.
Yes, yeah, this is the Vox. They just want to know more about your personal life here, and I'm sort of going through that, so we can get pretty personal. Gloria, your wife, does she do some of the cooking at home? And you mentioned she does. Does she use any of your recipes? Does she have her own style of cooking that's different than yours?
That's a leading question. Don't that show go to Connecticut?
That's true. We can make it. We can keep it from Connecticut.
Sometimes she gets me crazy. Like she does. I did a book.
Sure, it's a two-way street.
A book I did before I did La Technique was called A French Chef Cooks at Home, and I did a cheesecake in there. Now I've been married 43 years. She's done that cake two, three times a year, probably 150 times, whatever. That cake has 2 packages of cream cheese, 4 eggs, a teaspoon of vanilla, 1/2 cup of sugar. I think that's about it, you know. Each time she had the book in front of her to lick through the cheese. And she always does this one. I must have done another 6 cheesecakes in other book. No, she's break on this one, and this is it. So when she does it, and when she cooks, it's interesting because my daughter, Claudine, will have dishes that she prefers that I do, other dishes that she likes it better from her mother, other from her grandmother, my mother. So this is the way when you are in a family, you know, what stays in your memory. And when my wife cooks and I come into the kitchen, it's not like she said, darling, what do you think? She usually said, don't touch anything. But when she starts to, what do you think here? That's an in. I know I can't come in now, so but I'm careful.
She has her cues that you know well.
Yes.
So some people think that Claudine didn't know how to cook and she was learning on the show. Other people think that she was feigning the ignorance of not knowing how. What was it? Was it a mix of both?
She didn't know anything.
She didn't know anything.
No. No, because, you know, people don't realize. People say, you know, what do you think of your father? She said, well, I never have another father. So, I mean, you know, not like a big deal. I'm her father. Fine. So she ate from the best chef, from talking about André Saltner, Lutèce in New York, since she was born, and going to France too, and the greatest food. But she never really cooked herself because she came home, her mother cooked or I cooked. It's not like a big deal. So when we did the show together, she was at BU at the time, the first show. And so she knew all those tastes and all that, but really didn't know how to do it. So she would say, wow, that's how you do that. People thought it was fake. It wasn't. In fact, I didn't even tell her what we cook that day so that I had normal reaction from her. So she went to BU and did a degree in philosophy and political science, worked a couple of years, and went back into the graduate school to do a degree in international relations, political science. Once spent a year in Brussels with NATO to write a paper on the defense of Europe, came back and started selling wine. That's what she did. Now she had a cooking school in Denver. She lived in Denver and she had a little cooking school with a friend of her.
I think it's a quality of life issue. Following you around to all of these events and festivals, right. And you wind up watching somebody make a good living, eating and drinking. What I like to tell my friends is I'm not rich, but I do what rich people like to do.
Yes, and true, and so, you don't pay for it.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's good. Yeah, this is the greatest part of being in the food world, and I have to say the food world is very, very generous. I mean, it has been extremely generous to me, but I give a good third of my time to one charity or another. It's not special. Most chefs do. I can go to Roland Passot, I was last night at La Folie. I can go to his office and find 15 requests in 1 month for doing a dinner for cystic fibrosis, AIDS, battered woman, or whatever, you know. Because everything is filtered through food. If you ask people to come to a thing and pay $300 to hear someone speak or whatever, you will or you won't, but if you say, okay, we have 20 chefs cooking too, and the wine is donated too, people will come and shed that type of money. And that's what they do from all kind of charity. That's what we do now. And the chef give a great deal of their time. The guy works 6 days a week, and on Sunday, on his day off, instead of staying with the kid, he goes to do a dinner for whatever, for free. Don't you think people are very generous in our trade?
Absolutely. Yes. Every month there's, you know, two or three charity events that chefs are participating in. On a different side of that, though, I see a lot of restaurants popping up where the food is spectacular and you walk in and the air is cold. The hospitality seems somehow get short shrift in some restaurants. And when you're talking to your students about becoming great chefs, how do you communicate the importance of the reason why we do this in the first place?
It's a very tenuous thing, you know. I mean, you'll go to a restaurant. I remember going to New York, a new restaurant opened, and someone goes, and I say, how was it? Said, it was very good. I said, did you like the food? Said, food was great. How was the service? It was very good, too. Everything was very good, but they are not going to go back. And then you have one next to it. Everything was great, too, and you go back over and over again. I mean, sometimes it's very tenuous why a restaurant works exactly right. And another one, everything seemed to be right, but it just doesn't click exactly the way it should be, you know. That happened all the time. But to a certain extent, it always amounts to the same thing, you know. Food, quality of the food versus price, you know. And people say, well, we don't have any wine because people don't like green. It's green here. We're going to repaint everything yellow and do that to change the banquet and people are going to flock in. Of course not, you know. It's always a question of price. If you really eat well somewhere and the price are, you know, minimal and so forth with your wine, and people will come back. But certainly, without any question, when I had a restaurant in Connecticut, I had a restaurant in New York, I would take waitress who had never been waitress even, rather than have someone who is very snotty or condescending or whatever.
Right.
And I say, I don't ever want to hear from any of you that this is not my table or whatever. Someone asks you something, you have to smile and all that. On a small bistro, that's the way it should be. You should be felt welcome, and in the old style, people would make a big, big effort to remember your name and remember what you ate. So you haven't been there like 6 months, and they say, hi, how are you, Jacques? You still want your scotch with this? You say, wow. Right there, it's won. You know, they warn you because this is the way it is in the dining room, which is different than in the kitchen, of course.
You were a chef for a few French presidents, Charles de Gaulle. What was it like to be in those kitchens? And was it luxurious and really just over-the-top experience? Yeah, or was it just grunt work?
Between 56 and 59, it's a long time ago. You know, someone told me the other day, that man was chef to three French presidents, and the three of them are dead. So, but surely I think one is still alive. Yes, it was certainly with de Gaulle, who came in the 12th of May, 1958. I was with him and until I came practically to this country. And we did state dinner, you know, like I did Eisenhower, Nehru, Tito, Macmillan. Those were the head of state at the time that we would do. That usually we deal with the protocol. The protocol will come and say, okay, the dinner has got to be an hour and a half long, no more, or this or that, with one main course or two or three or whatever, depending on the importance of it. The wine, there is certain requirement which may have to do with health as well as religion. I mean, you're not going to give a ham to the king of Morocco or, you know, one of those things. There is certain thing that you have to respect.
Usually, or Israel.
And also the fact, or Israel, yes. Also the fact that maybe the same fish was served the night before in another state dinner, so they'll tell you. So you work out your menu around this. It's one way. But then otherwise, like, you always work with the lady of the house. So I work with Madame de Gaulle for the menu during the week, for the president, and certainly on Sunday, they ate, they were very devout Catholic, and then they went to church. And on Sunday after church, the family ate their children, grandchildren, and all that, like 8, 10, 12 people. And at that point, of course, it was the menu that we decided with Madame de Gaulle. Very simple, straightforward, high quality, simply prepared. You know, the greatest food is simply prepared, you know, highest quality ingredient and small portion. I mean, this is even the motto of Escoffier. But this is to a certain extent what we did. You know, there was much less emphasis on presentation, you know, amazing plate or whatever at the time. It was prepared very simply, very cleanly, and so forth. And I have to say that at the end of the month, I had to do an accounting for what we spent to pay the butcher and, fishman and so forth. And I had to do a special accounting to give Madame de Gaulle for the Sunday meal. They pay from their own pocket, which was kind of a drop of water in what we spent. But it was a question of principle. It was a question of ethic. And you do have to admire and respect that, considering that he had no money himself. He wasn't a wealthy person, but it was a question of principle. So it was a great time.
Times have changed.
Yeah.
So you had an opportunity to be the chef for Kennedy, right? John F. Kennedy, and
yes.
You turned that down.
Yes, because, you look at it 40 years later, it's another world. I was the chef with the president in France. I have never been on a newspaper in my life. Television did not barely existed. Radio, I never been on a radio show. Magazine, newspaper, or any of those things, because the cook at that time was at the bottom of the social scale. You know, we never have a, people will call you in the dining room and get kudo when you come in for the chef. Are you kidding? That did not exist at all. The chef was in a black hole somewhere, period. That's the way it was.
Right.
I went to the apartment of the president when I left because they asked me to come, and you see how it's sadly enough, because they will shake my hand and he gave me a cigar. Smoke that to my health. I mean, you know, totally, you wouldn't say that now. It was another world. But certainly, right. I had no inkling, no idea of the potential of publicity, you know, as you could go going to the White House. And in fact, the person before René Verdon, who went to the White House eventually, started with Jacqueline Kennedy. The people before that, you would never know who they were. It just did not exist. So we were at the bottom of the social scale, even though now we are genius. It's different, but So I had no idea. I was studying at Columbia University in New York. I worked at the Pavilion. I already had friends and all that, so I didn't really want to uproot myself again. And then I had that job offer at Howard Johnson. Howard Johnson was a client of the Pavilion, and he told Pierre, one day you're going to work for me. And so I went with Pierre, and it was another world. I learned there. I learned about mass production, marketing, chemistry of food. I learned new words like specific gravity, coliform, bacteria. You know, so it was another world. And I worked there from 7 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, so I could go to Columbia in the afternoon. So it was convenient. And I worked there 10 years as director of research, from 1960 to 1970. I opened a restaurant in New York called La Potagerie in 1970. Then I opened the World Trade Center with Joe Baum in the Two Tower. I set up the commissary. Then I was a consultant for the Russian Tea Room, year after Ligot. But any of those jobs, I would not have been able to do it only with my French training. You know, that helps, but what I learned at Howard Johnson was very important there. So I did learn a great deal about American habit, taste, and so forth, which I didn't know.
You know? And now you are the swarthy grandfather on Ugly Betty. Tell us about that.
Yes. Anyone saw me Thursday on Ugly Betty?
Well, somebody here saw you on Ugly Betty.
Yes. They called me. They called me like a couple of months ago and said, "Could you come and interview for us?" So I was in New York. I said, "Sure." So I go to Silver Cup Studio in Queens, New York, and I read a thing for a French grandfather. You know. So, and I said, "Well, how did you pick me up?" He said, "Well, we had a part for a chef a few months ago, and we thought of you, and we look at some of your stuff, and then that part was cut out of the script. But then that thing came on as a grandfather, and we thought of you again. So I went, and I was a grandfather. So,
do you think it'll be a recurring role, maybe?
I hope not, no. No.
Back to the some of the historic figures you've been around. Are there any people in history or even around today that you would love to cook for? Because I know that's sort of one of the, you know, the...
Yeah, standard question, yes. Yeah. I mean, there is no greater pleasure than to cook for your close friend and for your wife or your spouse or your family or your kid. This is really the best, you know, in terms. That being said, I did a master's thesis on Voltaire, so I think I'd like to cook for Voltaire. I did another piece.
What would you make?
That's an interesting thing. Voltaire was a very adventurous type of cook, as opposed to Diderot in the 18th century, when there was the battle between the nouvelle and the ancien, you know, the ancient, a little bit like nouvelle cuisine too. So I probably would do something more in the style of nouvelle cuisine for him. But I would like to cook for Camus as well. Camus was very important in my life, as a writer, mm-hmm. during my existentialist time, during my 20s. But there is many other people in this country. I mean, I was very friend with Danny Kaye, you know, and I cooked with him for years, you know, and he was a great guy and a terrific cook.
He was quite the bon vivant, right?
Yeah. I'm very friend with Morley Safer, for example. Now he lives next to me in Connecticut, you know, so I know him for 25 years or whatever. So we cook together often. And other people like this are great.
What are some of the things you like to do when you're not cooking? What relaxes
you? Well,
I
have a book. I did a book called The Apprentice, which was a cook's memoir, you know, like my... not really a biography, because an autobiography, because I didn't really talk about my sex life. So it's more of a cook's memoir. And starting when I was 13 years old, of course, until now. And I did a book last year called Chez Jacques, and it was a very kind of lavish coffee table cookbook, widely illustrated and all that. And it's a kind of... visual autobiography, if you want. So you saw me there in the wood picking up wild mushroom, which we do a lot in Connecticut, playing boule. You know, boule is the kind of batchy ball we play in France, going fishing for the tiny white bait that we fry, all kind of stuff that we
and
do at home.
And you had one recipe for each chapter, right? Didn't you?
No. I had a recipe for each chapter in the Apprentice.
Oh, okay, yeah.
This one had 100 of my best recipe. And I have a series of essays like painting. And I have a lot of my artwork in it, and I have at least 20 of my painting I paint for the last 40 years or more in there. So there is a lot of very personal in that book. So recipe that I have in that book is what, you know, what I like to eat, really, and mm-hmm. what we do at home and so forth, you know.
Outside of America and France, where do you find inspiration for really interesting culinary ideas now?
But all over, you know, I am the executive culinary director of Oceania Cruise Line, and I'll be doing a cruise next month. I'll go from Barcelona. I have been, as I say, on 16 cities, and I'm going back home on the 30th. And over the weekend, I'll be home. The week after, I'm at the school in New York. And then the weekend home, we're going on a cruise with my wife, and we'll be back in Miami. So we're crossing the Atlantic. We're going to Funchal, you know, in Madeira and the Azores, and I think in Bermuda and so forth. And I get ideas all over, you know, whether it's on board, where I work with the chef a little bit. I, you know, do a couple of demonstrations because I'm involved with the line, but. You know, I live in January, February. We go to Playa del Carmen in Mexico, next to Cancun. We have an apartment there, so we go there for a couple of months at least, and we rent the apartment. You can go on jacquespepin.com, playadelcarmen.com, and can rent my apartment for Playa is a great place. So my wife,
the turndown chocolates are amazing.
Right, yeah. My wife, being born in Manhattan from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father, so she liked the hot weather. So we go there, and she tried to extend it every year. So now we go there like 9-10 weeks, and which for me, you know, after a while, I get pretty bored. But in any case, I get idea there. I go to the market. I go to struggle with my Spanish to buy fish from the fishermen. They come back in the morning. I go with my friend Jean-Claude, and so we do that. Our life is always one way or the other involved into the cooking, going to the market there, seeing what we do. I mean, this is really a great part of our life, you know, to see what we ate, discuss it, what we are eating, discuss it, what we are going to eat, discussing, and so forth.
Right. As a Jew from New York, that's exactly how we plan our day. Breakfast is a meeting about lunch. Lunch is a meeting about dinner.
Yeah. Right.
Now the book is out, More Fast Food My Way. The show is on the air. That means you're working on the next project, right? So what's on the table right now on the drafting board?
Actually, I wasn't going to do another cookbook now, and I'm doing a compilation of probably 1,000 recipes. I think I have like 23 or 24 cookbooks. People already ask me, and I never know the number, and people say, how come you don't know the number? The point is that, like when I did a show here on PBS, I did a show called Today's Gourmet, 26 show, we did a small book. Then we did another Today's Gourmet, we did another book. A third one, we did another book. So we had 3 books. Then we put it all together into a large book called Jacques Pépin's Table. So now do I have 4 books or 1? You know, so I think I have 1 book. So that's what happened. Now I have probably 8 or 9 books still in print, but a bunch are not in print. So at Houghton and Mifflin, my editor said that I would like to bring all of your recipes back into a large book. I would want you to look at it, re-edit them, you know, work on them and so forth. And this is what I'm doing now. So.
Well, we look forward to that. Thank you very
much,
Chef Jacques Pépin.
Thank you
so much.
This
concludes the interview portion of the evening. Please give Jacques Pépin a round of applause.
Thank you very much. Thank you,
Jacques. Thank you so much.